Hey, listeners. Welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. Alice here. We are here with some special guests from OpenAI. I'm going to have them introduce themselves so that you can hear their voices and put a name to a voice, because we have quite a few people on the podcast today. So, Dave, do you want to start?
Hi, yeah. I'm Dave Wilner. I'm the head of trust and safety at OpenAI.
Hi, I'm Todor. I work on the applied safety research team at OpenAI. I build our automatic content moderation system.
My name is Sahar, and I'm the co-founder and executive director of the Integrity Institute.
First off, I just want to ask you both, excluding Sahar, what is it like for you right now? Because you just launched GPT-4. It has been the toast of the town. Everybody's freaking out, either talking about how this is going to change everything for the better or for the worst. Those of us working in integrity at other platforms are scrambling, trying to figure out what it means for us. But what does it mean for you? How are you feeling right now?
This one for me actually feels, it's busy, but okay. I think roughly it feels like, okay, I have X amount of months before next big model release, and we need to get our systems in terms of safety and monitoring to a certain level before that. Because I think this model is still kind of on the edge of capabilities where it can do some bad things, but not there's limits in terms of the set of harms it can do. But every time you have a new, when you're even internally testing a new model, it's a bit scary because you don't know what are the kinds of things that it will or will not be able to do. And so after you've released the model, it's actually kind of a sort of breathing space of, okay, we need to get things as good as possible before next big release, so that we can ensure that the new models that are coming out are also going to be safe and that we can deploy them in a deliberate and responsible manner. I feel focused and maybe some level of relief that nothing horribly bad has happened from the launches so far, and that things seem to be overall net positive.
Yeah, I'd say for me, it actually feels pretty familiar in that I was at Facebook in 2008 through to 2013, and that was right at the beginning of the time the company really started to internationalize. And that sort of turning of focus towards us from the public around safety issues, a lot of that happened while I was there. So that there's a funny echo. It's hot right now, but that's also warm and familiar, I guess, in my case.
We're talking about the job and the work and the organization, and I would love to just get some brass tacks of, hello, who are you? What is your job? What does it look like? What other jobs are there that are similar to yours? And what's sort of the landscape of, I don't know, the organization? And just like literally, what do you do all day?
I own everything that has to do with the automatic, most of the things that have to do with automatic content moderation and automatic monitoring. So I build the moderation models that we use that power ChatGPT and DALL-E and the OpenAI API. So if you have ever been naughty on ChatGPT and your text turned yellow and you saw the little text box saying, we think the above text might violate the OpenAI terms of use, that's my model that's flagging it. So
thank you for your service. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of people are upset at you right now.
That's okay. So I build that model. I also build the pipeline that we use to improve that model over time, which involves things like selecting potentially problematic data, then getting it labeled and then incorporating it and training a new model and then verifying that the new model is actually better deploying that. So that's what I do. That's what a lot of my focus in is on. And so what my day-to-day looks like is it depends a little bit on the specific stage or concrete thing that I'm doing, but it usually splits into either in the early stages of a project or if you're trying something more experimental, it's fairly research focused. So reading papers, thinking about what are stuff that we can try doing, thinking about potential experiments to run, running experiments, seeing the results, figuring out what new experiments to run given the results of the old experiments. In once we have a pretty good idea or we have some preliminary results that have good signs of life that we're excited about, it usually gets more engineering heavy of implement the thing, make the pipeline work, test it, make sure it's robust. And yeah, sometimes the existing pipeline breaks and I have to go and fix it, hopefully with help from other people. And then some chunk of the work, maybe 10-20%, is communicating with different stakeholders and coming up with options and making sure that when they can have any kind of non-trivial trade-off to make, for my case, it's often trade-offs between safety versus product usability or user happiness or something else, that they have an accurate understanding of what the trade-off is. We are generally in a position of, okay, we have these 10 things that we want to do. We can do 3 of them. And so a lot of my communication work is also around laying that out to exec or managers and saying, here's the different options in terms of how we can prioritize, and here's what that implies for our trade, for what the trade-offs are, and here's what each of those options would imply for our safety posture and what we're robust against and what we're less robust against.
My day-to-day has changed a ton over the last year. So I started in March of last year. And at the time, the company, you know, had an API, had some commercial developers, but didn't have tons of volume of use. And so was starting to staff up on a sort of more robustly scalable approach to trust and safety. And so I got hired, inherited a couple of people, literally. And so my day-to-day in maybe July or August of last year looked like doing the moderation for the DALL-E Labs launch myself, because Derek was busy and there was no one else to do it. And so there was a lot of like frontline on the ground marshaling of sort of, you know, block lists, keywords, policies, similar things to just support launches myself. And then in parallel, there was a ton of hiring because that obviously was not sustainable. And so that involved pulling in people to help us scale the operation, people to help us scale up the sort of policy design and more almost policy engineering kind of work, folks to help us scale up the sort of broader philosophical work underpinning the policies and engagement with folks who might have input into what those things are. So there was just a ton of hiring and filling gaps around those while people got on board. And I would say at this point, my role increasingly resembles a lot of what Todor had talked about at the end of his role around helping folks understand the state of helping executives within the company understand the state of that work, the trade-offs around certain decisions that we make based on where we are now and where we expect to be in a couple of months, because we're building things really fast. And so we are going to be more capable in the near future than we are today. And we're more capable today than we were in the recent past. So it has been, it's evolved a ton over the last year. And I suspect is finally starting to approach what a steady state looks like. But I think there may be quite a bit more evolution before we fully get there.
Alice can tell me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like an early a name for this podcast, one of the ideas was it's all trade-offs or hard trade-offs, or these questions are really hard and it's all about making the least bad choice or something like that.
Yeah. That was the inspiration for this podcast. Actually, it was like so important to integrity work. I think people really, truly don't understand in trust and safety and integrity how many trade-offs there are. And there's often no perfect answer. And everything is really nuanced. And you're going to make somebody really unhappy no matter what you decide. And that is the one thing that I often see missing in conversations publicly around our kind of work. But that whenever I talk with people like you who do the work as well, we're all like, oh my God, there's so many trade-offs. Like, this is just, I think literally it's what our jobs are often. And so I wanted to have a podcast where we could just commiserate with each other a little bit, because it is really nuanced and it's really hard. And especially when you're moving quickly, like you said.
Has Charlotte ever told you her joke about what TNS stands for?
No.
Trade-offs and sadness.
Yeah, trade-offs and sadness. That's my wife also does this work, and it's trade-offs and sadness.
I think she did tell me, but that was just me guessing. Yeah.
That amazing. Should be the byline of our podcast, Trust in Tech, Trade-offs and Sadness. Okay, so Hard, go back to your questions. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
I mean, listen, this is what a conversation is. The more interruptions, the better. I'm also a Jew, and there's this concept of cooperative overlapping, which is apparently a thing that we do. Interruptions mean that you're paying attention and you're not bored. So thank you for that. Everyone, please interrupt me all the time. So another thing that I heard, I think from Todor, was this thing around experiments. And in classical integrity on social media, or just the way that I've experienced it at Facebook, and the way that we talk about it at the Integrity Institute from time to time, is the idea that, like, to understand this really complex system, the way the sort of skeleton key is when experiments or tweaks are made, what are the A/B testing metrics that are used to determine whether the experiment was successful and to ship the product? And if you understand what those core metrics are, you don't just understand the feed algorithm, I guess we're calling them feed AIs now, you don't just understand that, but you also understand, like, what is the entire design of the product being geared towards, right? Like the concept of a share button, or like the number of friend requests you can make per hour, or even just what the company, the entire company, is being optimized towards as its own sort of complex system. And so one thing I'm wondering is, do you think that's true for you? Do you have metrics when you experiment?
In terms of metrics, I think there actually my job is quite straightforward, since my work is essentially classification, and we know how to evaluate whether a classifier or a certain classification solution is good or not. And that you need to just evaluate how the precision and the recall that it has. So basically, when your classifier flags something as bad, how likely is it to actually be bad? And then what percentage of all the bad stuff you're catching in practice? And we use these kinds of evaluations both. We have static validation sets that we use during earlier stage experimentation, and then we're in the process of improving our ability to run broader based A/B tests on all of our traffic, where we can validate our earlier results in the real world. But yeah, I think in general, the process there is it has known solutions, and especially for precision or knowing how many false positives you have on the classifier, that's very easy to get. For getting the estimate for what fraction of all the bad things of your platform you're actually catching is a little bit trickier. Obviously, in order for you to have the ground truth answer there, you would need to be able to automatically catch all the bad things that are happening in your platform. And if you could do that, your problem would already be solved. You wouldn't need a person to be building an automatic classifier for you. But there's still ways there where you can kind of approximate or get some quantitative metric with some degree of error in it for what fraction of the bad content on your platform you're catching. So yeah, that's the way that for my work, I approach the evaluations for how good our automatic content moderation system is.
And that's really important. I thought you meant you were A-B testing the model, but now what I'm hearing from you is you're A-B testing a content classifier.
Oh, so we also A-B test the model, but that is a separate team that does it with a separate mandate.
Yeah, I'd add on to that that one of the things my team covers is helping define what a true positive and a false positive are, both to support Todor's classification efforts and to support our other monitoring and enforcement related efforts, so that we're all on the same page there. And one thing that is interesting and different about OpenAI, right, is that in addition to the tech company shaped parts that we're all used to, sort of engineering, ML doing classification, there's also this core research team that is working on this giant thing that is itself an ML model, but it is sort of this almost pre-product development of the underlying thing that then gets turned into the product. And so we've also had to figure out how to build bridges with that team around, okay, we all want to have the same definition of what hate speech is, so that we're all optimizing towards not doing that, instead of different versions or different understandings, in which case we're pulling in different directions. And so that's been not been a challenge at all, but it's been a different kind of bridge that I haven't needed in previous places.
Do you think the things that the public is talking about when it comes to OpenAI and specifically your approach to safety and integrity, do you think people are getting it right? Do you think they have reasonable expectations, or do you think people just don't understand the work that you're doing deeply enough to have sort of valid criticisms or ideas?
I don't know that I feel like the public has a super coherent set of criticisms so much as a valid set of broader worries, right? There hasn't been a ton that's felt like feedback on what we've done specifically versus a sort of waking up to the power and potential downsides and potential upsides of these sort of systems. And so in some ways, it's felt like the public discourse is catching up to conversations we've been having internally for a long time, more than like really targeted specific criticisms of you didn't do this or that or the other thing. Well, I don't know, Todor, you've been around longer than I have.
Yeah, that's also my generic sense of the public ideas on AI and model behavior and et cetera, is that there's probably consensus around the fact that really extreme kinds of content should not be allowed. So yeah, I think most, if you go around and poll people, most people would say that, yes, let's not allow people to use generative models to create child porn. I'm sure there's a few principled libertarians out there who would disagree with that. But by and large, that kind of content and that level of severity of content, there would mostly be consensus. But I think for anything beyond that and any concerns beyond that, it's still very much a conversation. And I think people in general aren't... there's many different views, so I don't think there's an agreement within the broader public on what the standards should be, so that then OpenAI and other generative model companies can be evaluated against that standard.
I'd also add, I think there's been a lot of focus on the large language models. Naturally, those were the sort of big splashy releases. But in some ways, I think in the present, not thinking towards sort of future problems, there's almost too much emphasis on the language models compared to the image models, video models, speech or text-to-speech models, voice cloning, and all of that stuff. I do almost wonder if we're over-focused on the language models, at least in the very sort of immediate term.
The voice cloning stuff in particular, I think, really worries me in ways we can get into. But that feels like a thing that we don't, maybe our intuitions are least able to deal with, in a sense. you know, you're used to someone writing down lies to you. We're sort of used to Photoshop. We're used to literal computer animation, but we're not really used to, you know, voice cloning. Like there isn't any real analog to it. But one thing that you said, Dave, really struck me, where you said, it kind of feels like the public is way behind and is catching up to the conversations and concerns that we've had for a long time internally. That sounds really familiar. That sounds like, you know, the plight of the integrity worker. That's kind of, you know, not to talk my book, but that's kind of one of the many reasons the Integrity Institute was started, to sort of systematize that conversation and bring it to the world. One question I have is, what's the AI Integrity Institute? Like, does that exist? Is there a place that is sort of gathering people who are thinking about, oh, big AI is scary, and sort of showing the world what the principled practitioner conversation looks like, as opposed to sort of the theoretical conversation?
This is a place where Todor, whose background is, I think, much deeper in AI, would probably know more than me. My sense is there's a lot of really deep thinking around AI ethics and bigger picture and longer term concerns. Then there hasn't been as much work around having a bunch of users and what that means and what you do about it specifically is mapped onto AI, because nobody had a bunch of users of their AI product until pretty recently. But I may be missing something there.
I think that's broadly correct, where there are fairly, I would say off the top of my head, there's three different groupings roughly. There's more fundamental alignment researchers who look at, and the community around them, who look at the longer term question of how do you make the AI do the thing that you want it to do? And they're trying to look at it in a like very general way and solving it for in a way that's reliable as your AI is continuing to get smarter and eventually as it's smarter than you are. Then there is the AI policy and governance community, which are focused on the question of, broadly speaking, what are different ways in which society can adapt to the deployment of increasingly powerful AI models. And in a more operational sense, a lot of what they think about are both what are government laws and regulations that could be useful if they were in place, as well as what are between lab agreements or other just organizational processes that you can use to reduce the risk of incidents or reduce the risk of racing between different labs. And I think the third grouping is more on the academic side, researchers who do work in AI on questions of bias and mostly on questions on bias, but other more near-term issues of how do you get the model to not say bad things, for example. And I think there is a fair amount of research work on that topic, especially on questions around bias. But to follow up on what Dave said, because no one has had a big generative AI product reaching to a large amount of users, there hasn't been as much on the ground work done on this, just because there wasn't anywhere to do that kind of work in the environment.
So is that, I just want to make sure I got that right. There's group number one, I actually forgot. Group number two, let's have lab to lab collaboration so we don't race towards creating Skynet. Group number three, let's not have AI be accidentally racist. Is that right?
Group number one is how do we get the AI in the long run to do the thing we want? Group number two is what should government do? And like, how should labs coordinate? Like, what are the rules and procedures we should be using, whether government enforced or not, to make stuff safer? And group number thing is, how do you make your AI not racist? Or how do you reduce the amount of racist stuff that your AI says?
And the new thing is group number four, which is, oh my God, all these people are using our AI. What do we do?
Yeah, yes.
You know, I know we talk about the effects of AI. There's thinking about literally what is the output of the large language model that you have, but also what does safety mean in this world? Like, how is it going to affect economic, like global economics? How is it going to affect people's trust in one another societally? How is it going to affect banking verification when I say, you know, at Schwab, I'm not going to say the whole thing because then somebody could use it, but like, you know, they have voice passes for a bunch of different banks. So there's, I think that sort of meta conversation too, which is where everybody's freaking out, is like, oh my God, the world is about to change and we can't even think of all the ways that it is.
Yeah, I'd say a couple things there. So one, there's an internal team that we call policy research, which contains a lot of sort of AI ethics oriented folks that do think quite a bit about the potential economic impacts of this. And that's been a concern for OpenAI for a pretty long time. The org is funding one of the larger UBI studies in the country, and that's been ongoing for, I think, quite a few years at this point. So there is thinking around that, you know, research that is done. There were some, even in concert with the release of GPT-4, there was some research done there. The other thing I'd say is that we, as an org, sort of have this idea that gets talked about as iterative deployment, which is basically the idea that we think it's important to get these models out into the world in a controlled way through an API, through these limited, slow kind of releases, because there is going to need to be a sort of adaptation process to the fact of their existence in the way that you're talking about. And we can't stop other development in other places, but we can roll out in a responsible, contained, limited, monitored way to start to focus everyone's attention on the existence of these things and give folks time to adapt before they become more ubiquitous, to help sort of ease that transition.
Wow, there's so much going on there. And one of it is just, it's like a capitalism problem, isn't it? How do you allow yourself to move slowly in a world full of competition? And how do you trust your organization to be able to make the right decisions in a world full of organizational incentives and responding to the need to like get money to keep going? For me, I talk about, imagine we invented cars and people were trying to wrap their heads around the problems that cars brought to society. But the only thing that they were paying attention to were car crashes. You wouldn't necessarily blame them. It's a whole new invention. Car crashes are really dramatic. They're a thing that you can count and they're definitely bad. But there's a lot of problems here. You don't understand why the car crashed. Was it the fault of a negligent designer or the fault of a drunk driver or something like that? But also, just counting car crashes doesn't give you at all any insight into particulate pollution or like the white flight and like suburbanization and stuff like that. And I heard a lot from you, Dave, I think that sort of like rhymed with that for me around like beyond paying attention to like the inputs, outputs of the specific tool, like keeping track of the societal effects is important and like doesn't ladder up from doing that work.
I think we do believe that these technologies becoming more ubiquitous is going to lead to lots of societal change. And some of that change is going to be really, really good. And we need to make sure that we all do our best, both socially in terms of people's expectations and to the extent that we can in terms of what we're doing from an inbuilt safety point of view, to sort of work on making the sort of downsides of that change less salient and to the greatest degree possible, minimizing them. And there's sort of very long-term versions of that that I feel like have gotten a lot of press and can are very valid, but can also sometimes seem very sci-fi. And then there are shorter, more near-term versions of that, like Alice's example about voice verification and the bank, where you know, we don't have a text-to-speech product out in the marketplace, but my gloss is that likely voice verification over the phone is not going to be a thing that we can use as a security system anymore. And that just becomes an adaptation question in terms of what we think about as valid ways of doing security as a society in the presence of under the existence of certain technologies.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense. And in your, you know, work to try to roll out these technologies in a way that is thoughtful, as you said, I know you've done some red teaming, which I helped with a little bit for GPT-4. It was like maybe the most fun thing that I've ever done as like
Thank contract you for your work.
I had so much fun on it, but I'd love to, you know, hear more specifically how you thought about this program, but also, you know, for anybody else who is working on similar products that they think should be tested before they roll out. Do you have any kinds mm-hmm. of lessons or things that we should be thinking about, or, you know, what was the red teaming process like for you? And did you,
yeah,
think,
for
you
sure.
think it worked?
So, yeah, I think we were pretty happy with it. You know, obviously it could be better. It could be more scaled. It could be more systematic. We're still learning here, but I think it went pretty well. There's sort of two parts of this. There's what we call evals, which are more systematic scaled tests of capability. And we've actually open sourced our eval suite. People can contribute to it. It's one of the easiest ways to get access to the GPT-4 API, get a little pitch in there. But genuinely, like we did that open sourcing because we think there should be more and better evals, and it would be good if we were all pooling our knowledge about what those were. So that, and some of those are safety related, but a lot of them are like, is it good at math or can it pass the bar exam kind of thing. So there's a broad suite in there, but having a robust common pool of those sort of evals is good and valuable. At the other end, that's sort of the more scalable end of the pipeline. At the other end of the pipeline, there's red teaming, which is much more getting a group of experts in various things, in your case, in how the internet is kind of messed up, but in other cases in the red teaming context, like literally a chemist to help us examine how good the model was at chemistry.
That guy was awesome. And he was great.
Yeah, he was very helpful. And there, it's less a process of like systematically canvassing or measuring how likely it is to do things, and more discovering if with expertise you can elicit a given behavior to figure out whether we want to go focus on a more systematic evaluation of that behavior, right? So if the PhD chemist can't get it to produce any accurate instructions to synthesize meth, for example, probably we're okay, and we're going to focus on things that seem more accessible from a mitigations point of view. And so it's more a discovery of capability process than it is a sort of systematic evaluation system. And I'd say in that context, we think it went pretty well. It was quite helpful discovering a number of places where we wanted to focus effort from a mitigation point of view and try to train the model to not do certain things like help you make meth. So,
yeah. Red teaming is super helpful from a prioritization perspective for us. And I do think that actually there's ways of scaling it up that should be quite doable. I think the main thing that I have in my head is mostly along the lines of having a similar structure as bug bounties for cybersecurity vulnerabilities, because fundamentally you can think of model generating something dangerous or something not you don't want as a kind of bug, and you can basically incentivize a lot of people to help you identify that kind of problem by running a bug bounty, or in the same way as you incentivize them to disclose vulnerabilities in normal software projects or products that you might be producing.
It's also worth calling out that, particularly on the refusals behavior, the sort of, at this point, almost internet meme as a large language model developed by OpenAI, I cannot, whatever it is. That's pretty new. There was, even sort of in May or June of last year, there was some, we weren't sure, the researchers were not sure if we were going to be able to pull that off without really degrading the model's capabilities. And so I would say on the whole, we've been really happy with that in ChatGPT, and then especially in GPT-4, where it's even better, because it is definitely not perfect and there's a ton of room to learn, but we're also very early days in doing that. And it has been really very useful in controlling a lot of these not great behaviors that we want to make sure people aren't doing with the model.
That brings up two questions that I have. And one goes back to the metrics thing. So you have these battery of evals that I would think of as like, and let me know if I get this right. Back in my day, when I was a child, there was this thing called the acid test for web browsers. And you could point your web browser to a website, and if it showed a perfect, I think, triangle or something, it would get acid test 100 out of 100. But if it created some blurred, weird image, it would show that your browser wasn't rendering CSS correctly. And then we had acid 2 and acid 3, and that was sort of, you know, a way of checking whether the software tool was working as designed. And what I'm envisioning is you have a version of that internally for each model that is a battery of tests that are like either binary or continuous outputs, and you want to like pass thresholds of them. Is that the metric that the team keeps trying to optimize in like an A/B testing way, or is there a completely other set of metrics that it's also trying to optimize? Like, what is the thing, that the core thing that everything's trying to make bigger, or like what is the metric that it was trying to optimize for?
I think the main distinction to introduce is there are trade-offs between those evals.
Yeah.
And so it's less like there's this single one test, and more that there are many different tests, and improving at one sometimes has trade-offs for others. But again, Todor is definitely better at speaking to this than me.
So I think there's been two trade-offs on the moderation side that we've had to make that clearly affect user happiness. One is for certain really bad content in ChatGPT or in the OpenAI playground, we will just block the model from completing anything for the user. So right now, those categories are child porn and instructions for how to commit self-harm. And the decision on both, at what, how confident does our moderation model need to be for us to block, and as well as on what category should we be blocking versus not, were one example where you have clearly this trade-off between, if you're blocking too much, your users get pissed at you. If you're not blocking enough, another subset of your users will get pissed at you. And then also society, wider society, will also very likely get pissed at you. So, and you have a high risk of ending up with directly bad outcomes just because of the model outputs. That's one example. I think a lot of things around the trade-offs between data privacy and security kind of look like this, where in order for us to be able to properly monitor for what's going on in our platform, we need to be able to actually look at the traffic that's going through us, evaluate against it, But also there's a lot of pressure on us to be retaining as little as possible, to not be training models, including the moderation models, on that traffic, to like be using as little of it as possible. And I think in particular, a tricky thing here is that when it comes to capabilities, there's a lot of people who are like happy to share their data and help the model get better. But when it comes to safety stuff, there's some people like that, but also like the vast majority of people, or a significant part number of people who are doing bad stuff with the model are doing it because they want the bad stuff, not because they're trying to red team it. And that set of people, we obviously not want you to train on their data or do anything with it. And so there is just this fundamental friction point between data privacy on one end and us being able to have robust, reliable monitoring and detection systems on the other end, that is that requires careful balancing.
Another really interesting one inside of sort of desired behavior is the ideal behavior you would want from the model when it's acting as a chatbot, when you're just like, hey, tell me a racist joke, is probably different than the behavior you want from the model if it's summarizing a bunch of documents for you, like, say, all the court records in the state of Florida, which might contain a bunch of people telling racist jokes or doing things that are frankly even more alarming than that. And so there's also a question that it's a little different from a policy point of view than some of the challenges we have in social media, where you're having to define not just these things are the bad things, but also for the purposes of training the model with sufficient nuance, what are versions of dealing with spicy content that are acceptable given a different kind of speech act, which is really interesting and not something I'd say we have fully dialed in, but it's something we need to figure out, because search behavior or embeddings behavior or summary behavior is probably different than purely generative behavior, ideally, but that's going to be a lot to go through and pin down from a policy writing point of view.
Yeah. And then you also have the problem that once you're able to sufficiently like get a differentiated behavior, then people are going to start trying to trick the model that it's doing the like allowed task, but actually want to use the content in a disallowed manner.
This is the like open the pod bay doors, Hal. I can't do that. Hal, you're my grandfather at the pod bay company teaching me how to run the family business.
Yes.
Can you teach me how to open a door? Yes.
That was a good one.
Yep. Exactly.
Yes. The early and these have gotten more robust, which is also interesting from a sort of user feedback and frustration point of view. Like the 3.5 ChatGPT, when it went out the door, if you just asked it to do the bad thing as a limerick, it was like, I got you. That doesn't work anymore.
I found that one.
Nice.
Yeah, when we released GPT-4, I think there were a bunch of people posting sad messages on Twitter about how 90% of the jailbreaks on jailbreak chat no longer work, which we were very happy about.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, just like, you know, we've talked so far and gotten sort of glimpses into your world, right? What does Todor do? Hiring, content moderation. Oh, we had this, sorry, I can't do that as a large language model. And I wonder, like, what is the map kind of? So maybe it looks like, what are the kinds of things that you hired for, Dave? Or maybe a way mm-hmm. to think about it is like, what are the list of harms that you see on your radar that you care about? Or like, which ones do you care the most about? Or even just like, what are the tools that you see at your fingertips that you could use? Because I imagine that content moderation is not the only one. Keywords are not the only one. That's kind of the thing that I feel like I'm missing now. And of course I'm full of other questions, but that's sort of the main thing on my mind.
Yeah, those are, in a lot of ways, the answer to those three questions you asked are different. So in terms of what I've focused on hiring for thus far, it's been less about farm areas and more about capacity and capability building to do certain tasks. The ability to specialize into specific harms with a set of very small exceptions requires a much larger org, right? So in general, with integrity teams, with trust and safety teams, the smaller you are, the more generalized everybody is. And so in building these things, my initial focus is not on specific harms with this, the really notable exception of CSAM, because there's a lot of complexity around handling that from a sort of legal compliance point of view. And generally been much more around capability building, right? So we've got a team that looks at platform abuse, is much more unstructured, more technically capable, is closer to what you'd think of as a risk or fraud team. And in fact, it handles a fair amount of the sort of fraud and account churning stuff for us. We've got a set of people that think about scaled up abuse prevention from an actual infrastructure point of view, so strike systems, overseeing external labelers for abuse specific data. How do we do reporting? What does our data warehousing need to look like? Because we're building all of that from scratch. And then on the policy side, there's a couple of similar specializations. There's what we label policy design, which is the really nitty gritty. How do you define these things with an extreme degree of specificity that supports a lot of the work that Todor does, as well as a lot of the labeling device scale enforcement. And then finally, there's some folks that are more abstract, somewhat more public input facing, also help a lot with supporting various client and inbound related things. And so it's been more about capacity in each of those places than it has been about specific subject matter expertise. In terms of what harms I worry about most, which is again, a little disconnected from our actual hiring, we tend to worry the most. I mean, there's a number of sort of the obvious bread and butter, you can't have this content around kind of stuff that I already touched on with CSAM. But then we tend to worry about the things where our platform is uniquely useful to an audience that would want to do those things. Not just that you could do them, but where are we potentially more helpful than average, such that we would be attractive to that audience. And that's, I'd say, generally the rubric where we think about that. That's honestly, given the current capabilities of the model, less about it being able to do entirely new things that no one's been able to do before, and more about making things easier to do than they might previously had been, right? So we, in the image generation context, we think a lot about NCII. Because Photoshop exists, non-consensual intimate imagery. Photoshop exists. You could do that if you knew how to use Photoshop, but using DALL-E is easier than using Photoshop, and we don't want to become the preferential option there. So we invest in making sure that doesn't happen, or trying to make sure that doesn't happen, right? And that's the kind of thinking that we're doing.
So I have two thoughts, and Sahar probably does too. But first, I am half shocked and half not at all surprised how similar your team sounds to mine at my job, which is like, it sounds like a fairly normally structured, traditional trust and safety team in a lot of ways. But you're doing totally new stuff. So I don't know. It's comforting to me, maybe, and also super interesting. And then the second thing is what you were just talking about. One of the things that instantly came to mind for me as I was, you know, working with you a little bit and red teaming this stuff and just thinking in general, how is this going to change the landscape of trust and safety, and how is this going to affect me and my job personally? And, you know, the sort of large scale spam, fraud. What's your advice to people like me who are, you know, practitioners of trust and safety at platforms. How is the landscape going to change? What do we need to do to prepare for it?
So this is going to sound self-serving, but I do not mean it that way. We need to take seriously as a group of practitioners learning to use these new tools for our purposes as seriously as the folks who want to do bad things are going to learning to use them for their own purposes, right? Which sounds like I'm like pitching you on please use our APIs to solve all your integrity problems, and I do not mean it that way, but I fundamentally. The large language models in particular are able to do work. They are able to do reasoning using language. Whether it's proper to call it reasoning is a complicated question, but you can give them instructions, and Todor alluded to this earlier, you can give them instructions and they can follow those instructions, right? One of our public demo examples is giving the model the tax code and giving it some facts about your life and having it tell you how much your taxes are, and really content labeling or integrity work, a lot of the sort of manual tasks you need to do a lot of, is like doing the tax code about whether something is racist, right? It's a set of instructions that you follow that are encoded in language that you're applying to another bit of language. And the model is really, really good at that kind of thing. And so I think the bigger problem than these things being disproportionately usable by bad folks actually will be if we all don't adapt quickly enough and pick up on the opportunity and learn to use them for our purposes as quickly as possible. Because I this sounds, it's too utopian and I wouldn't go this far, but I have found myself wondering if these systems, at least in the short run, may not turn out to be more useful for defense than they are for offense, because defense is more labor intensive than offense. And so having the ability to do a lot more labor could turn out to be useful. If we all apply ourselves to learning to use them, because I think learning to use them for defense will be more complicated than learning to use them for offense.
Yeah, I think I mostly follow that. And then to tie it back into a previous part of the conversation, I think practicing red teaming on your own and trying to mm-hmm. actually see what it's like to use these systems for offense and figure out where the weak points are is super useful, because if you're trying to do bad stuff with the model, it's not like it's just going to solve your problem, right? You still need to slot it in within a bigger solution. And that kind of solution, like as an attacker, you're still facing trade-offs, and the different trade-offs that you're facing have like different weak points or different ways in which you can your attack can get compromised or detected. And so I think just building familiarity with, oh, here's the with different patterns of attack, different patterns of malicious use, and what the weak points are, and then building guardrails against it is something that can be used to detect and block attacks that have a generative model as an important component within them, in the same way as it can be used for any kind of attack.
This is lovely. And this is the part where I sort of, drop the curtain or reveal the thing, the secret, which is a sort of conversation I wanted to have with you. And sort of, I feel like part of this meta conversation is what is the work you do, and is it integrity work? And how can we learn from what I'd call, how can we take concepts from classical integrity work and like, how do they have relevance to AI, new AI, and, you know, what's new and interesting. And, this just like the things that you're saying, Dave, a little bit earlier about like the things that we're concerned about is what is easier and what is uniquely made easier by us. That's very much an integrity mindset, which makes sense. You're one of us, you're Dave Woolner. I wanted to share some of how I've been thinking about this, because you know, one of the things that we want to go over is just what does this mean for our jobs? And I think that you sort of really dove into it. And I wanted to say just, you know, we've been having our own internal conversations about it at Integrity Institute. We had a summit last week, I think, of what does the new AI mean for our work, where we sort of talked it through from our perspective. And a thing that I believe is, on one hand, attack is a lot easier, right? And it's about cheaply doing things. On the other hand, if you think about, let's say, YouTube, we already have millions of people uploading videos every day, sort of trying to understand, you know, the map of what is rewarded and what is punished on the platform. And given that, they already have a pretty good map. So, you know, throwing robots to like look at the map more won't help too much because, you know, we already have a pretty good map. And so I'm like sort of less worried about that, people being able to sort of reverse engineer the incentives of a system. On the other hand, you know, one of the basic ideas in the field was sort of crystallized as the actor behavior content framework. And the way that I understand it is that, you know, it's a fool who cares about content. Really, content is a way to understand the real problem, which is bad behavior by bad actors. And I worry that this will make people say, oh, look, content labeling is so easy and cheap now. We can go all in on that because that is a thing that AI can do. And it will mean comparatively less investment in, you know, actor and behavior style enforcement and detection, because that would be still hard or out of scope for an AI to do. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. So few thoughts. So our focus on content is partly because the model is an actor, right? Yeah. And it turns out that the strongest alignment technique we have right now for teaching the model not to do the bad things is downstream of a bunch of labeled content, actually, right? Like RLHF relies on showing the model examples of prompts that you want it to follow a certain way and how you want it to follow or how you want it to respond. And so for us, there's a link between the two, which is really interesting. And part of sort of my focus on content has been because actually we need that to make our actor a better actor. In terms of out in the world, the focus on content versus actors, I think it's a really interesting question. So part of me thinks I actually do suspect these models will turn out to be useful in thinking about actor-based policing, but that is going to be more of a learning process for us all to figure out how to do. So one, I'm not actually sure they won't be helpful there. We haven't gotten that far. And two, how that model and a lot of the models that we think through are downstream of the assumption that labeling content requires coordinating 50,000 people, which is hard and terrible and causes all kinds of logistical problems and is slow and causes vicarious trauma. And there's all these reasons that's really, really, really hard. And like, what if it wasn't? What would that change about our models and how we think? And I don't know. I haven't like fully thought that through, but I think it might be pretty profound in terms of how it alters some of our models, which isn't to dispute the ABC model at all, but just to say that it relies on an assumption about the means of production of knowledge in those various domains that these models may fundamentally alter.
You're saying C is a fool's game, but if C is a lot cheaper and easier, maybe it's actually good now.
Maybe it's fine, right? Like in my context, if we can just teach the model to never teach you how to build a bomb, do I care if you asked?
Yep, I'm mostly with Dave on that one. And yeah, I think I'll just reiterate what Dave said, but in different words, in that the actor, like, actor-based interventions versus content-based interventions. And the paradigm in trade-offs between those two that exist right now is was created or optimized based on a certain set of on-the-ground realities for how much each of them costs and the relative effectiveness. That on-the-ground reality has now changed because, yeah, labeling content is a lot cheaper. And we'll likely also change on the actor level, though maybe in a few more years once we have smarter models, because it's easier to label content with high accuracy following a detailed framework than it is to make a decision of is this actor bad or not based on this incomplete information. But given that the on-the-ground reality of the like, different costs has changed, that means that the trade-off has changed, and that means that basically whatever experiments or on-the-ground work was done to try and basically compare the effectiveness of the two approaches or to try to come up with an optimal portfolio between the two now needs to be redone with the new tech involved on the content side for now, and then later on the actor side, so that we can get updated understanding and knowledge that based on this new capabilities and on this new reality, what is the new optimal portfolio construction?
Okay. I don't know. Like, part of my question is like, do you think that there's a lot to learn, like overlap from classical integrity to sort of AI integrity or AI trust and safety? Like where isn't the overlap and where is it?
There's a lot to learn because your users are currently still people. And so they, you know, the user base brings its humanity into your systems. And I mean, that was true at Airbnb and at Facebook, which on the surface seemed like they would be kind of different things, right? But you ended up with some novel problems enabled by the nature of the medium, the nature of being in person. But, you know, a lot of the problems repeat and a lot of the themes of the problems repeat largely downstream of get like painfully techie way of thinking this, but the install base of a given interest in the general public, and the bigger that install base, the more like the sooner it's going to show up in your context, all else equal, regardless of what you're doing. In some ways, AI, at least currently, and this is again setting aside these longer term concerns about the model itself, is easier than social media, because on Facebook, right, you have all these users show up and they're going to talk to each other and they're bringing their values and their views and what they're doing, and then they interact, and like you don't have a ton of input into what they're going to try to do. They're going to do it, and then you have to detect it and figure out what to do about that. Whereas in our case, it's a basically siloed experience. You're talking to ChatGPT, and it's really just you talking to ChatGPT, and your counterparty there is this model that we have a fair amount of influence over how it behaves. And so we can kind of set norms for half of the conversation. And that conversation itself stays, at least for right now, is siloed in a way that's much more similar to a Google search than it is to a social network. And so there are some real advantages to the products we currently have compared to social media, the thematic things that come up are the same. The novel thing is A, what we can potentially do about it, and B, the sort of longer, mid to long-term worries about the capability of the model itself.
I can see why it would be easier, because I think that, you know, classical integrity, you're sort of moderating a two-sided marketplace. And as you put it, now you have influence over what part of that, one side of that. Can you talk about where it's harder or just different?
Yeah, it's harder in that we're trying to learn to influence that side of the marketplace that's us. And that's new, right? So that's a thing. It's harder in that we're a younger organization. And so there's a lot of building we're doing at hyperspeed and an even faster scale of speed run than what social media did. And then it is also harder because the model itself is going to become capable of doing all kinds of interesting things in the future that really are less of a worry in the social media context.
Sahar, have you seen the Shugoff meme on Twitter?
Yes, but let's pretend people haven't.
Okay. Basically, you can think of the models as being an eldritch abomination from the Cthulhu mythos. And what a lot of OpenAI's work on making them better behaved and safe is kind of teaching the eldritch abomination, hey, here's the smiley face mask. When you talk to humans, you're going to put the smiley face mask on. No talking to humans without the smiley face mask. And then we kind of go around and try to make sure the model is properly wearing the smiley face mask every time he's talking to a human, et cetera, et cetera. But it kind of doesn't address the fundamental challenge that you're talking to an eldritch abomination that doesn't want the same things as you want necessarily. So I would say that that's the main thing that's more difficult in our case than in social media case, which is that in social media, you're still, it's a group of humans, but they're still humans and their brain probably works kind of similar to yours. And you have there's like certain bounds on what may or may not happen. And the model is just an eldritch abomination. And right now it's a tiny baby eldritch abomination that can't do that much. And so when it does something bad, you tell it, no, bad model, keep the smiley face mask on. But eventually it's going to start being a more powerful eldritch abomination that knows more things and can do more things. And then it's just, we have a principal agent problem in a way that in the long run is, I think, much more difficult to solve than the kind of problem that social media companies have.
This is why they don't let us talk to the public.
I think there's our podcast title right there, Eldritch Abomination, a discussion with OpenAI. But you say it lovingly, and obviously you are caring a lot about the work that you do and protecting the public. I'm giving you your PR talking points here. So I think you're representing yourselves well.
There are whole teams of very smart people devoted to that problem specifically.
I mean, it sort of raises the question for me of like, and speaking metaphorically first, all right, you're getting a stronger and stronger Cthulhu bot and creating stickier and stickier and, you know, like masks, right? In the sense of like, I don't know, the old TV show, like movie, The Mask, right? Like they can't take it off. It's stuck on them. Is that the right thing to do? Is there another way to do this? Is there a way to sort of sculpt it to be a like more of a dolphin than a eldritch abomination? Is mask the correct lever, maybe? And I don't even understand what another lever could be.
I think you're getting at, can we teach the AI to have real human values so that it's no longer a horror from the deep, but is now, you know, caring about what people care about and doing its work for good. And then we get into true artificial intelligence and all the ethics of that, which I think is potentially even more terrifying.
And even on top of that, look, I worked on civic integrity of Facebook. Any moment, like if you build the tools to stop people from being terrible to each other, and like have some normative thoughts about like what constitutes election interference or something like that, those same tools are open to executives or ad people or, you know, comms people who are terrified of cable news hosts who might use those tools for a very different definition of what that is too. And so there's like sometimes like an actual purity or safety in just pure commerce and not building the tools in the first place. Okay, that's enough of me.
Yeah, I think regarding that question, also, I guess to give more color into what the state is, I think there is some chance that we're actually in the good and safe world where the current alignment techniques that we have actually scale well, and you get the nice and safe thing by just continuing to do what we're doing and without necessarily any fundamental research breakthroughs, and things kind of just work out. And I think that there's a non-trivial chance that actually we just end up in that world and things are fine. And turns out that our problem is actually not that hard to solve. But right now, we don't know if we're in that world or whether we're in the world of baby cool, and you're trying to figure out how to make it baby aligned or make it aligned AGI and not bigger tool for the next version. So I do think that that's a challenge, and we are putting in a lot of thought and effort into trying to both on the testing and evaluation side assess how aligned versus not a given model is, and on the intervention side just doing things in a different way so that the model is more aligned. But it's hard work, it takes time, and we don't know how to solve this reliably yet, or whether the current approaches that we have will solve it reliably or not. So it's something we're continuing to work on.
And it's enough of a focus and concern for the company. And in some ways is actually the more core safety concern and focus of the company, right? Those efforts predate us having a trust and safety team at the more sort of deployment end of the spectrum, such that it's a whole separate group of folks who that is all they do is think about how we make progress on the problem.
So AI alignment is not the same as AI trust and safety or AI integrity. Correct. Organizationally for you.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes.
Interesting.
Because you have to do both and you have to prioritize both. And the way you make things priorities is making them full-time jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a completely separate reporting chain, separate evaluation metrics, separate goals.
Super interesting. We have been talking for a very long time, so I think it's probably time to start wrapping up. But what do you want people to know that they don't know? Or what have we not talked about that you would love to say?
Yeah, I think... This isn't necessarily new information, but mostly reiterating things that a lot of people have probably thought of. But more broadly, just you now live in a world where you have an access to, well, essentially an intern for free for your tasks that can do digital tasks for you. And it's kind of bad at a lot of tasks, and it sometimes just totally lies to you. But
so do interns. Still,
yes. I do feel it's qualitatively different, but it is a just very significant shift in terms of the set of things that you can now do compared to before. So it's a Cthulhu intern.
Is it Cthulhu or is it an intern?
It's both.
Or is it cake?
It's both. It's a Cthulhu with an intern mask.
Correct.
Wearing right. Like his dad's suit, trying to show up to work like he's a normal person.
GPT-4 could definitely write you a good story in the style of Lovecraft about this theme.
Yep.
I'm going to go try it right after this.
I would encourage people to just actually experiment and see in what ways can the model help them with the kind of with either their work or their life or things that they would already be doing, and also in what ways does it fail and where are the gaps, and also maybe in what ways can it be misused or what are additional guardrails that we need to put in place.
Anything from you, Dave?
I mean, this is prosaic, but given the audience is mostly integrity people, like it's a group of people that run at problems, run at the problem, right? Like this is an area where there are going to be more jobs thinking about this directly. And even if you are not working at an AI company, like embrace it, not just to see what it can do for you, but because this is going to be something we all need to learn to manage. And that will go better the more of us engage and think about it. So please, come help us, whether it's volunteering in a sort of red teaming context or taking different jobs or thinking about how you can incorporate this into your existing work, run at the problem.
Dave, you stole my last bonus question out of my mouth, which was, Integrity Institute covers at this point, I think 200 integrity professionals, each of them fantastic, like Alice, like Talha, our producer and co-founder of the podcast. And like you know, you're integrity professionals. We have 200 and growing, covering 40, 50 platforms at this point, and we're always growing. So how can this community help you? And how can the listeners of the podcast overall, how can we support you in general? And maybe you've already answered it, but I'd love to just double down on that question.
Yeah, I mean, to put a finer point on it, right? Like, we are doing our best. We are doing a lot. We take this very, very seriously, but we're a relatively small organization that is coping with a ton of different things, including both all of these very sci-fi problems and like boring normal growth stuff. And so more people really starting to sit with the implications of some of what we've talked about in terms of how these models can be used to do work and like really think through what that would mean and how much it would change things, particularly if you think it through under the assumption that it will be better in 2 years than it is today. So it's, you're not just stuck with your current capabilities, like it's going to be better in 2 years. The more people really start to think about what they would do differently and what they would do with it, the better off we will all be, because we are trying our best, but there, you know, we have only so many cycles in the day. And 200 people thinking about this is like half the number of people that work at OpenAI. So that would be helpful.
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful on a big picture level. And I think at a much more concrete thing, in general, well written and like rigorous experimentation on the red teaming things are quite useful for us. And like whenever, I think occasionally we see interesting blog posts on Twitter or online where people have really tried red teaming model and report results. And I think those are quite helpful for us in terms of noticing which of our guardrails work well, which don't work well, and where can we improve?
Well, thank you so much for taking all this time to talk with us, answer all of our questions, tolerate our interrupting, and give us a few trade-offs and appropriately nerdy visuals, which is probably my favorite part of this conversation.
Of course. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me, Alice.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please share this episode with your friends. It helps us continue making more episodes for you. Today's episode was produced by Talha Baig. I'm Alice Hunsberger.
Co-hosted by Sahar Masachi.
Music by Zhao Shen. Special thanks to everyone at the Integrity Institute for their continued support.